Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing Jeremy because I hope everybody knows him. You're here to see Jeremy tonight, to hear him tonight, yes? Good, you're in the right place. We know who Jeremy is. He's with Democracy Now!, The Nation, and the author of a terrific book. It's really an honor for me to host this conversation. Let's give him a big warm welcome. Really good to see you, man.
When I heard that Barry was going to do this, I was like, oh, okay, it's the CIA sending their man in San Francisco after me.
Keep a close watch on things.
No, but if you haven't read Barry's novels, I actually get a shout out in one of the novels, so Barry's sort of my agent now. But they're fantastic, fantastic books that tell stories that a lot of us as journalists aren't able to tell, because you hear these things in war zones or in the course of reporting on intelligence or security, and you don't have a second source on it, or you just have a strong sense that it's true, but you can't figure out how to prove it. And in Barry's novels, he sort of follows through to the sort of end of the earth on the expansion of these covert wars and can tell a story in a way that I'm not able to through nonfiction.
You are really nice. Most of what I learn from Jeremy, from journalists.
It's going to be like this all night.
I know, but so here's a question that I wanted to start with. I love the book. It's amazing. And as someone who's in the business of choosing titles and covers and that sort of thing, I was knocked out by the title of the book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. And I thought it was just the absolute perfect and appropriate way of encapsulating the entire story you tell. So to start with, I would love to hear you talk a little bit about how you chose that title and what it is intended to stand for.
You know, in the beginning, the first title that I had come up with for the book, when it was really going to be a book all about JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, this elite force, it was going to be called American Ninjas. And then the second one, which everyone hated, but I loved it, was it's even hard to describe it, which is why it's not a good title, was F-cubed, like after the third power. Find, fix, finish, which is jargon within the sort of targeted killing community. You find the target, you fix their location, and then you finish them off. But F-cubed was nixed, and so we came to Dirty Wars. And, you know, when I was thinking about what to call the book, I realized as I was, you know, two-thirds done writing it, that really what we're heading into now, the era that we're heading into, is very similar to U.S. policy in the 1980s, when you had the Reagan-Bush administration fueling these dirty wars in Central America, the Contras in Nicaragua, and backing death squads in El Salvador, and Battalion 316 in Honduras, and you had this sort of full spectrum of covert operations, the military, the CIA, supporting these juntas, supporting death squads, and trying to conceal the U.S., fingerprints on the operations. Also, I called it Dirty Wars because I think that there is a sense among particularly a lot of liberals right now who are passionately supporting the president as waging a smarter form of war, is that the drone wars are clean. And so it's sort of pushback on that. The subtitle of it, The World is a Battlefield, is actually a quote from a guy who works in the JSOC community who told me that the world is a battlefield now, meaning that the U.S. can strike wherever it wants, whenever it wants. But it actually is what he's referring to is military doctrine that I'm sure you're familiar with, called operational preparation of the battle space. And basically, preparation of the battle space provides that if the U.S. military believes that there will be hostilities, future hostilities in a country or a war, that special operations forces can forward deploy to those countries in the absence of a declaration of war and operate in a covert nature to prepare the battle space. And Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld really did start to perceive the entire world as the battle space, and so they started to expand the operations of JSOC, and that's something that continues under President Obama.
Yeah. And recently we had Senator Lindsey Graham making sure, just in case anyone missed the point, it's not just, when we say that the world is a battlefield, it means including the homeland is a battlefield, in his, what I find a memorably creepy phrase. But does he not have a point? I mean, a lot of people will say, in fact, Lindsey Graham himself said that the reason the homeland is the battlefield is because the terrorists think it's the battlefield, and therefore it is.
Right. I mean, I think that we've sort of made into this giant boogeyman terrorism as this existential threat to our society. It's not that there aren't real plots. There are very real plots. There are people that want to blow up U.S. airplanes. There's a guy who tried to set off a bomb in Times Square. There was a plot to bomb the subways. I mean, these things are happening. Right. But I think that what we as a society are so quick to militarize our approach to combating drugs, to combating terrorism is a form of crime. When you're plotting to blow something up, it's the same as it's the same effect as someone going into one of our schools and shooting it. So in sort of reacting to, you know, a very real problem, albeit one that I think is exaggerated in terms of its level of importance or the level of threat, I think we're losing part of our own values. And you know, the idea that international terrorists could threaten the existence of the democratic system in the United States is just, you know, totally false. Yeah. These people do need to be confronted who are plotting, but I think we have a robust legal system in this country. The only successful prosecutions since 9/11 have been through the civilian justice system. We've got people languishing in Guantanamo who've been cleared for release, and they're still sitting there. So, I you know, when they called for this Tsarnaev kid, Jahar Tsarnaev, who, you know, is suspected of being one of the, right. the bombers in Boston, those guys, the Republicans, were calling for him to be treated as an enemy combatant, and some were saying he should be, you know, sent to Guantanamo. If that's going to be our response as a society to certain kinds of crimes, where it's like the mob can come with the pitchforks and, you know, torches to deliver citizens justice, then we're actually a different country, and we should stop portraying ourselves as sort of different than the rest of the world.
So this is one of the things that I think you can almost call a theme in the book, and that really interested me because it kept coming up again and again. You don't depict lawmakers overtly saying the law doesn't matter or America is no longer a nation under the rule of law. Nobody says that. But what they do is they look at the law and they find ways, often through twisting the language, to render the law, to neuter it. So, for example, assassinations are illegal. We have a presidential, an executive order prohibiting assassinations. How do you get around that? They call them targeted killings of enemy combatants. That's not an assassination.
Right.
You're not allowed to torture. So, well, then it's not torture.
It's enhanced interrogation techniques. Or, you know.
Exactly. So that was. How much of that do you see as a problem in America cashing in its values, maybe without even being aware of it?
Right. You know what's interesting about the executive order prohibiting assassination? There's an interesting history to how that happened. You know, remember that the first president to sign that executive order was Gerald Ford. Yeah. And it was coming out of this era, the Nixon era, where you had the Church Committee that was investigating assassinations. You had the House Committee on political assassinations. And Ford issued that executive order, but Congress has never passed it as a law. There's been discussion of it, but Congress hasn't passed it as a law. And the reason is because Congress doesn't want to be on record saying that the commander in chief can't do these kinds of killing operations. Right. So it's something where assassination is very narrowly defined. When it was originally signed by Gerald Ford, it was just political assassinations. And Jimmy Carter, when he was president, removed the word political, and then he added any agents of the U.S. government, meaning contractors or people that are working as assets for the U.S., potentially in intelligence services. And every president, all the way through President Obama, has kept some form of that executive order on paper. And each one of those presidents have found a way to systematically violate their own order by saying, well, it's not an assassination. This is a strike aimed at military facilities in Baghdad, for instance, when Clinton bombed Baghdad in December of 1998.
Yes. I find that a fascinating way to end run any law you want. Declaring, for example, the Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment are pretty clear on, for example, the government not being able to deprive anyone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and the Sixth Amendment is clear on right to counsel. So how do you get around that? Well, you just declare someone an enemy combatant. And in fact, this is something you talk about in the epilogue of the book, and I would love to hear more about it. The Pentagon General Counsel, Jay Johnson.
Yeah.
Essentially saying, like, look, you know, these laws make sense in a civilian context, but we're not really in a civilian context anymore. And what he does is he takes the war, which should be the exception, and uses it to just smother the rule. So if the world is a battlefield, then...
Right, you know, I mean, it's interesting, too, because when confronted with what legal authorities the U.S. is using to justify the bombing of Yemen, the Obama administration will point to the original authorization for the use of military force, the AUMF, which was passed a few days after 9/11, and the only member of Congress that voted against that was Barbara Lee,
yeah.
And I describe her speech in the in the book because it was so unusual. If you remember the climate in the country at that time, she was trembling when she gave her speech because it, I mean, I think, you know, I haven't asked her about it, but I would imagine that she knew that she was doing something that was potentially career ending.
Oh yeah.
But, and actually
life ending. She received death threats after that speech.
But if you go back, I think it would be a really instructive, especially for young people, to go back and read Barbara Lee's speech, because she was 100% right about what was going to happen. She saw it coming, and it was quite prophetic. But the idea that now 12 years after that was passed, and it was passed to go after the people responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the overwhelming majority of Americans supported that, and the overwhelming majority of Americans supported a campaign to go after Osama bin Laden and break the back of the Al-Qaeda network. It was within a year that the mission turned into something different in Afghanistan, and then they start plotting for Iraq. And now here we are 12 years later, and President Obama is using this AUMF to go after people, some of whom were toddlers on 9/11, which was passed to go after the people responsible for the 9/11 attacks. So I think you're going to see liberals, and this has already started on MSNBC, calling for a repeal of the AUMF. Yeah. But there's something no one ever talks about. Article 2 of the Constitution, the Commander-in-Chief clauses, Cheney and Rumsfeld believed that made the president a dictator when it came to national security policy. And the Obama administration has continued to interpret it that way. So, I mean, what we've really seen is a bipartisan power grab by the executive branch that was legitimized by a constitutional law professor, Nobel Peace Prize winning president. I mean, it's quite amazing.
We live in strange times. If anyone who's interested in that Barbara Lee speech, I'm sure there are some Glenn Greenwald fans here tonight. If you haven't seen it already, he blogged about it, I think, the day before yesterday. It's one of his most recent blog posts. And there's a clip of the speech. It's pretty extraordinary, especially extraordinary to hear senators like Dick Durbin saying today that, well, nobody could have known what we were getting ourselves into with the AUMF, and that's demonstrably empirically untrue. People did know, and Barbara Lee was one of them.
Right, and it's fascinating when, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this, when there was a two-week period in late 2011, September, October, where President Obama authorized a series of drone strikes that resulted in killing three American citizens, none of whom had been charged with any crime or had evidence presented against them. And when that happened, and we can talk about the circumstances and who the people were, but when that happened, which was quite an extraordinary line to cross, there were only two basic reactions in Washington: silence or enthusiastic support. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sounded almost identical to John McCain and Lindsey Graham in praising that operation. And the only people that raised a voice against it or questioned it were Ron Paul, who at the time was waging an insurgent campaign for the Republican nomination for president, and Dennis Kucinich. And outside of that, I mean, the Democratic establishment has made possible the expansion of these strikes because there has been no serious questioning of the policy, no serious analysis for, you know, the entire duration of the Obama presidency.
What has been the effect, would you say, of the Obama presidency on this kind of creep in presidential unconstitutional exercise or exercise of unconstitutional powers?
I mean, first of all, I think there's a big difference between Obama and someone like Dick Cheney. Like I see though Dick Cheney sort of in his lair plotting the destruction of the world, so Halliburton stocks go. I mean, I actually think that the cartoonish Darth Vaderization of Dick Cheney is probably pretty accurate. I think he's a really rotten human being. But I think that President Obama has bought into this notion that he is waging a smarter war, and that this is the best way to keep America safe. And I think that they're starting to believe their own rhetoric about the effectiveness of the campaign. And so you asked me what sort of the impact has been. I believe that particularly in Yemen and Pakistan, that we're actually creating more enemies than we are killing terrorists. It's complicated. I don't necessarily think that we are aiding Al-Qaeda. That's the number one impact that's happening. I think what we're going to see is disparate groups pop up that are not Al-Qaeda, that are resistance movements that are motivated by legitimate grievances against the United States for killing their loved ones or wiping out a village. I had a very telling interaction. I don't normally interact with powerful officials at all. I mean, I'm not.
That's part of the reason you're such a terrific journalist, by the way.
Yeah, I don't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and laugh at the president making jokes about drone strikes, and I don't go to the Super Soaker parties at, you know, Joe Biden's.
You haven't swung on any tire
Chuck
swings.
Chuck Todd and I are not playing, you know, water balloon toss together.
No tire swings.
No tire swings, right. No shooting hoops. But I recently met a former senior official from the Obama administration who worked directly on the targeted killing program and was one of the people who would sign off on the strikes. And I asked him about a bombing that took place in Yemen. The first time that President Obama authorized an airstrike against Yemen was in December of 2009 in this village called Al Majla. And the U.S. intelligence indicated that it was an Al-Qaeda training facility. And I think that the Yemeni government and the Saudis had provided this intelligence to the U.S. And that's a whole other story. They feed bad intel all the time. So they do this strike, and it ends up killing 46 people. Yeah. You know, 14 of them are women, 21 are children. And, you know, when we went to Yemen, we went down to Abyan province where this was, and we videotaped the missile parts that are still there, these cruise missiles and the cluster bombs, and we gathered evidence from the survivors, video, horrifying video of the aftermath of this attack where just human beings were shredded into meat, basically. And it was, I mean, cluster bombs are a horrid weapon. They're like flying landmines. And, you know, the meat of animals with human flesh sort of all mixed together and babies being pulled out of rubble and, you know, so clear that this was a village of civilians. And I asked this former official who was in the White House at the time, you know, why did you sign off on a bombing that killed 46 people, 36 of whom were women and children? And he said, I never signed off on something that killed 36 women and children. And I said, but you signed off on the Majla strike. And he said, I'm saying to you, and he was talking to me like this, I never signed off on anything that killed 36 women and children. The sense I got was that they cannot face the idea that that's what happened there. And they need to believe that what they did was destroyed an Al-Qaeda camp, because otherwise, you're facing a moral crisis that you can't walk away from that. Jay Johnson said when he watched the satellite imagery of that attack, that if he were Catholic, he'd have to go to confession. Yeah. You know, but then this other guy is saying, I didn't do that. You know, they know exactly. You know,
there's a quote I love from Reinhold Niebuhr, I think from Immoral Man and Moral Society. And it's Immoral Man and Immoral Society. And it's hypocrisy is the tribute that the higher self has to pay the lesser self. Or rather, that the lesser self has to pay the higher self in order to get the higher self to do things that it otherwise would never do. And you see this kind of thing all the time. It comes out again and again in the book. By the way, this attack you're talking about is the centerpiece in the book, and it's horrifying to read about. And one of the things I wondered about, always wonder about these things as a novelist, how do people justify these things beforehand and afterward? And yeah, that's as good an explanation as I can come up
with.
Well,
I mean, I think that in Yemen in particular, there's an interesting spy game going on. I think the U.S. is getting played like a piano by the Saudis and at times by the Yemeni regime. The longtime dictator of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was a very crafty guy and knew how to play various forces off of each other. And I think when Obama came into office, they wanted to make their mark early and start striking because they had pledged to wage a smarter war, taking the fight to the terrorists. And so they're putting all this pressure on the Yemeni government, on the Pakistani government, to start working in more concert with the U.S. in these campaigns. And I think that Yemen realized that it needed to give results to the U.S. So they start saying, well, here in this village, there's a terrorist training camp, and there's this dangerous man named Mohammed al-Qasmi, and we need to take him out. Mohammed al-Qasmi was an old mujahideen who fought on the U.S. side in the Afghan war. That was the original target of that strike. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ridiculous. When you go there and you actually look at who was killed, I think the Yemeni government basically sold them this idea and told the Obama administration, here's this intel, and we're going to let you take out a dangerous terror network in our country. And I think that they thought, the Yemeni regime thought, it's a Bedouin village of poor people in the middle of nowhere. No one will ever go to follow up on it. There also was a case where U.S. forces killed a deputy governor of a province in Yemen who was a political opponent of the U.S.-backed dictator, because the U.S. was fed bad intelligence. They were taking out political opponents for dictators now. Then in Afghanistan, we tell these stories where it's like someone is upset, has a grudge against another family, and they know how the American system works. Three human intelligence reports of people going to an American base and saying, these guys are Taliban, you know, suicide bomber factory people. And then, you know, they go, one goes on a Tuesday, the other goes on a Thursday, the other goes on Sunday, and next thing you know, there's a night raid authorized. And so Navy SEALs go in, they think they're raiding a Taliban stronghold. Oops, we just killed a family. And, I mean, this happens over and over and over.
It's not new either. I mean, if you read about the Phoenix program in Vietnam and you see that all these programs get corrupted the same way, they're just because of the universal system of human incentives and disincentives. If you find some people who are saying, look, if they're communists or if they're terrorists, we've got some people who will kill them. you'll find some people saying, yeah, those guys are terrorists, those guys are communists, when in fact they're just people they don't like, or maybe they owe those people money and it would be convenient for them if they were to be taken out. And that's what happens to programs
like
this.
I mean, I compare sort of what JSOC was doing in Iraq. You know, there's this myth that David Petraeus won the Iraq war with his surge. I mean, it's just a crock. I mean, like, everyone in the military knows that's just, you know, bogus. I mean, David Petraeus has, if he had not gone down from the only thing that ever seems to bring political figures down in the U.S., you know, it's like, you know, it's what they're doing to people in private that gets them taken out. But what they do in public, even if it's criminal, it's like, you know, fail upwards. But what really happened in Iraq, and I get into great detail about this in the book, is that JSOC just turned into Murder, Inc., and they just started bumping people off. And that, in combination with the U.S. paying the Sunni tribes in Anbar province and elsewhere, the Awakening Councils, not to kill American soldiers or not to attack them, those two things were what caused this reduction in violence that allowed Petraeus to say that he had won the war. In reality, they had just killed a tremendous number of people. And then this massive civil war breaks out in Iraq, and it continues to this day. But JSOC developed this systematic way of hunting down and killing anyone that would pop up. And it wasn't even al-Qaeda anymore. It would be, this neighborhood has organized a resistance attack against it. Let's figure out who the three guys are, snatch one of them so we can kill the other two. And it goes on and on and on. And it's very similar to the Phoenix program. And there's a lot of mercenaries and forces from other countries that we're working with. Some very unsavory characters are back on the U.S. payroll right now. And it's, you know, I think somewhere Cheney is like sitting fly fishing thinking, it's kind of great that Obama did this. You know, this is going to be real helpful for Marco Rubio's administration or whatever, you know, Jeb Bush.
So you mentioned that the Yemeni government probably wasn't expecting journalists to be intrepid enough, courageous enough to actually go to the village and see what had been done there. And yet, so your journalism, your style of journalism, I hate to even call it that, because it's like it's real journalism, or the phrase independent journalism, which to me, it should, in fact, be redundant, and yet today it's really not.
Or we could just start calling the other stuff just stenography. And then we could reclaim our own term.
So often it really is.
Yeah.
Or Bart Gellman came up with a phrase I love and I used in one of my books, which is information laundering. You see this happening all the time. I mean, if you ask a child, why does the White House leak information to the New York Times so that the New York Times will print it? Why don't they just put it on whitehouse.gov?
Right.
And because wouldn't that be more efficient? You'd have to explain to the child, well, because then people would say, oh, this is coming from the White House, and immediately discount the value of the information. Whereas if it's coming from the New York Times, the newspaper of record, then it must automatically be true. It's really clever.
Well, we saw that awesome, we actually got a rare opportunity to see the sausage made with the whole Judith Miller-Dick Cheney relationship where, you know, Dick Cheney tells Judith Miller there's this mushroom cloud. Then Judith Miller prints this, that there's this mushroom cloud threat in Iraq. And then Cheney goes and meets the
Sunday
press and says,
shows, yeah.
Well, do you see what Judith Miller's reporting in
the
New York Times about the mushroom cloud?
It's amazing. It's a
self-licking ice cream cone, you know, like it's, as someone in the book told me, this former Special Forces
Such a, such a great line.
Yeah.
So this is something that sets you apart, and I don't mean to imply that you are unique in this regard. In the acknowledgments, you name many other, in my opinion, outstanding journalists. We mentioned Glenn Greenwald, Liliana Segura, Marcy Wheeler, Amy Davidson.
But also, corporate reporters. There are great reporters. C.J. Chivers of the New York Times, a fantastic reporter. There are major league.
Charlie Savage.
It's just few and far. Yeah, Charlie Savage. There are amazing people that work. That's why it's tough on how to define it, because they are out there and they do exist. But often the unfamous journalists who are doing the hardest work, and they're reporting in other languages, and they're not getting the byline in the New York Times or the Washington Post, but they're doing heroic, amazing reporting.
Yeah. So how do you change that? How do you change the impact? I mean, this is a nice turnout for me. It's just gratifying to see this many people who are concerned with what I consider to be real journalism. It's wonderful. But still, it seems like, you know, it's the New York Times, it's the Washington Post, it's CNN. Fox News. These are sort of the branded news outlets that people tend, depending in part on their political affiliations, tend to trust more. How can we do more to promote confidence on the part of the public in real journalists like you, and to promote more of a skeptical attitude toward the stenographers?
Right. I mean, it's interesting. I would bet that you and I have the same pattern, or correct me if I'm wrong. The first thing that I do when I get up in the morning is look at Twitter. I don't go to any news site anymore. It used to be that I would read international papers. I would, you know, I would read The Guardian, and I would read The Times of London, The Financial Times, and I would go to, and I would read all of these papers from around the world or certain blogs. Now I go to Twitter because you can curate your own list of individual reporters without having the middleman of their employer getting
that.
In the way.
Totally
and there are some great reporters who are breaking news on Twitter all the time. Yeah. I think we're at an interesting moment in the history of journalism right now where the monopoly of the corporations, even though they still control the airwaves and everything, their monopoly on the dissemination of information in any kind of a digestible way is broken. It's shattered.
Agreed.
Because of citizen journalists. What I think, I ultimately think, you know, we all are discussing how do you fund journalism, how do you keep it afloat. It's very hard. I spend several months a year fundraising to try to do this journalism. It's expensive to go on these trips, and I often end up begging people for money to go and do them. But I think that that's somewhere down the line, we have to figure out a way to combine what is so important about old school muckraking and have fact checkers and researchers and in some cases legal review of articles if you're reporting something sensitive with this great new open energy that is reflected by so many, particularly young journalists on Twitter. And I don't have the answer to it, but I'm excited about to see what the next generation of young journalists or aspiring journalists are going to bring. Because I think that we're going to see some really creative new approaches to disseminating information and analysis.
I agree. To me, the biggest challenge is one of branding. It's always interesting to me to see the way brands can endure long after the loss of whatever underlying substance once justified the brand. I mean, for example, I look at the New York Times. And not that the New York Times does no good. They do. They have some good reporters there. You mentioned it. The Charlie Savage generally is, I think, is excellent. But then when you read Harvard's studies, like the Harvard study showing that up until the Bush administration started calling waterboarding enhanced interrogation, the New York Times and some others, the Washington Post and CNN and I think the Wall Street Journal, all called waterboarding torture. But then they stopped and changed on a dime when the government started calling it something else. And I look at these things and I say, I feel like, how can I trust you if you're actually adopting the government's chosen nomenclature?
Right.
And then defending it, as Bill Keller has done many times. And yet somehow the New York Times brand is still, they call themselves the new newspaper of record. It's a really clever thing to award yourself.
All the news
that's fit to print, yeah.
I mean, it's not to turn this into a New York Times bashing session, but, you know, it was, one thing, and I write about this in the book, when this incredible story played out in Lahore, Pakistan, in January of 2011. Do people I'm sure remember the story of Raymond Davis,
sure.
The CIA contractor.
Again, great two chapters I think in the book on that.
Yeah, the curious case of Raymond Davis, Act One and Act Two is the title of it. But so Davis was this guy who crossed into a number of different parts of the global covert wars. He was a Blackwater contractor who also was a special forces guy who was on contract for the CIA in Pakistan. And what exactly he was doing is the source of a great deal of mystery. But he ends up in the streets of Lahore and shoots two Pakistani guys on a motorcycle and shoots them from the car and, you know, dead shots, and then goes up and pumps rounds into them. And then calmly walks back and gets in his car and tries to drive away. And he calls for backup, and a van comes and runs over another Pakistani. And it's unclear, you know, what exactly those guys were doing. But it seems that they were up to something, probably for JSOC on the side, also working with the CIA. But remember what was going on at that time. Raymond Davis gets put into this prison in Pakistan, and there's calls for his death, you know, from all throughout the country. And meanwhile, in Washington, Obama is being briefed on a house in Abbottabad, Pakistan, where they believe they found Osama bin Laden. And they wanted to hit Osama bin Laden much earlier in 2011, but they have a CIA Blackwater JSOC guy stuck in a Pakistani prison who just killed two guys that may have been ISI agents, Pakistani spies themselves. So they had to get Raymond Davis out of Pakistan because the assessment of the CIA was that if they did the bin Laden raid, that Raymond Davis would almost certainly be executed in that prison, if not killed by other prisoners, killed officially by the Pakistani government. So John Kerry, who of course now is the Secretary of State, went over there and negotiated with the Pakistanis. They basically, he and Hillary Clinton, they settled on a number to pay blood money to the families of those Pakistanis, and then they had to get Raymond Davis out. And he had sort of an unceremonious end to his career recently when he got into an altercation outside of an Einstein's Bagels and beat someone up over a parking spot. So Raymond Davis never faced any criminal charges for killing these people in the streets of Pakistan, but he did face criminal charges for battery outside, for beating someone up outside of an Einstein's bagel.
It reminds me of the fact that the government would need some sort of warrant to wiretap Anwar Awlaki, but needed no judicial or other due process really whatsoever to have him killed.
But that you're almost verbatim quoting Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, who said, you know, the liberals hit us so hard for the warrantless wiretapping stuff, but you're not demanding that there be a criminal charge against Awlaki before we kill him. I mean, just so people remember that, you know, Anwar Awlaki, and you know, we can, if people want to talk more about this later, we can, but Anwar Awlaki was a guy who many Americans, I think, just remember from one moment in his life, which is that he had this camouflage jacket on in front of a black flag calling for armed jihad against the United States. He really was a product of American foreign policy. He was radicalized as a result of watching the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, all of this stuff. And eventually then he's killed in Yemen. He was born in New Mexico and had been an imam at a mosque in Virginia. I've sort of been trying to figure out how to explain to people why I think that is such an important story. And I've really come to the conclusion, both morally and strategically, that it's not about who Awlaki was at all. It's about who we are as a society. You know, how do we handle the most reprehensible people in our society? Like, what should the standard be? Because that really is how we're judged as a society. So if there are certain people that aren't on declared battlefields that we've decided should be assassinated, then we should probably change the Constitution and say, well, these people actually don't have access to due process or the judicial process.
Yeah, and Awlaki, the story of Anwar Awlaki occupies a significant portion of the book. And in fact, I was going to use that very phrase. And I think for two reasons. One is, and I would love to hear you go on a little bit more about this, but one is Awlaki is emblematic of what our policies can do, how they can be counterproductive. You can take someone who originally was essentially sympathetic to the United States. This guy was, in fact, a United States citizen. After 9/11, he was on various news shows. He was considered a kind of textbook moderate Muslim who could explain that this is a perversion of Islam and this kind of thing is terrible and reprehensible. And then over the course of the intervening years became more and more radicalized by U.S. policies, to the point where the United States then had to kill him, which is the second thing that's emblematic of how far can these unconstitutional and extrajudicial policies go.
Right.
I think as far as they can go is where the president can start authorizing the execution of American citizens without due process. And so Awlaki is also the textbook example of that.
Yeah, and I mean, there's not many funny moments in the book, but at all, as you would imagine.
I don't know. It's called Dirty Wars. I don't know why.
No, it's a romantic comedy. We have a film that's
don't
coming
sell it
out.
Don't Hollywood. That will happen.
We have a film that's coming out by the same name, Dirty Wars, and it premiered at Sundance. And I was in like these lines with actual like movie stars who are being interviewed about their film by these women wearing these big furs and their hair is all done up and Demi Moore is doing whippets in some hot tub somewhere, and so here we are, and you're being interviewed, and they don't know like what our film is at all. They're just handed a card, Dirty Wars. You're speaking to the writer of it, and at one point I was being interviewed by a very large fur with a woman's face coming out of it on a red carpet, and she's like, "So, Dirty Horse." And I said, "Excuse me." She goes, "Tell us about Dirty Horse." And I didn't think she said horse. I thought she said something else. I'm like, "My God, how did I end up here?" But that's not the funny story in the book. The funny story in the book is that the CIA actually facilitated Anwar Awlaki marrying another wife while underground. They found him.
And it's amazing, amazing chapter in the book.
It's so surreal to me, and it's so awesome that you would not be able to make that story up to put into your novel.
Even if I thought of it, I wouldn't do it because I'd say nobody's going to believe
this. So this guy, I mean, this is such an epic story. There's this guy named Murad Storm, or Morton Storm, which is an awesome name, was a friend of Anwar Awlaki's in Yemen in the sort of mid-2000s, like 2004, 2005. They had studied at a university there together. And he was a former biker gang guy with a long criminal record, and he had converted to Islam and wanted to, aspired to sort of be a jihadist. And he had met Awlaki, early on before Awlaki went underground. And when it became clear that the U.S. was hunting Awlaki, Morton Storm thinks he can cash in on this. And he goes to, he was a Danish guy. He goes to the Danish intelligence service, the PET, and he says to them, you know, I'm in touch with Al-Laki and I can help you track him. And so he starts reaching out to Al-Laki, and then the PET, the Danish intelligence people, get in touch with the CIA, and the CIA send operatives over to go and meet with Morton Storm, and they start working together with Morton Storm, and I think the CIA paid him $250,000 at one point, and they gave him a briefcase with a code lock on it, and Storm asked them what the code is, and they said, try 007, which is like so cheesy, but it's awesomely true. So Morton Storm, he starts communicating with Al-Laki, and they come up with this idea, and it's unclear whose idea it was, the CIA's, Morton Storm's, or Al-Laki's, that Al-Laki needs a new wife to join him underground, because his first wife and his children were living with his family in Sana'a. He had nothing to do with them and is being chased by the U.S. So they hatch this plot, and Morton Storm literally places an ad on Facebook for a bride for Anwar Al-Laki, and they get all of these responses from women around the world wanting to marry Anwar Al-Laki. It's like jihadi OK Cupid or something. So they decide on this young woman who's a Croatian named Amina, who was a convert from Catholicism to Islam, and she and Al-Laki exchange a series of video messages to each other. And I have the video messages. So it's like, you know, she's describing why she wants to marry Anwar Al-Laki, and then Al-Laki is going back and explaining what life would be like for her, that she's, you know, you have to be willing to live in a tent and with a minimum number of toiletries available to you and all this stuff. And so Amina and Al-Laki agree that they are going to marry. So the CIA pays for Amina to fly to Yemen. But she doesn't know this at all. She just thinks that she's marrying Anwar Al-Laki, and that's what she wants to do in her video, say that she's ready to face death if necessary for her faith in Islam. And they give her luggage, like I imagine like these Louis Vuitton bags that they've given her that have tracking devices in them. And the plan was for her to go and meet up with Al-Laki and for the CIA to kill both of them in a drone strike. Which, I mean, on a moral level, it's just utterly reprehensible that you would use this, I mean, woman who has no idea that that's how she's being used to try to find him and then blow both of them up. So she lands in Sana'a, and Al-Laki's guys come to pick her up, and they ditch the luggage and tell her to change her clothes, and they give her new clothes, and so the luggage remains in Sana'a, and she goes and actually marries Anwar Al-Laki and has a child with him, and then lives life underground with Anwar Al-Laki.
And Storm kept the money.
So it's, and Morton Storm kept the money, and he's got a huge, I think, book contract right now, but it's that's why I call it the CIA's dating service. Yeah. And there you have the only funny thing in my book.
You know, that chapter was hard to believe. So, how do we, as a nation, as a society, how do we get back? How do we recover our adherence to the things we claim to value, the rule of law, the Constitution, those sorts of things that have become increasingly quaint? How do we find our way back to that?
Yeah.
Or is there a point you get where you get to a certain point and you can't find your way back?
Right. I mean, I think that there's only the very beginning of a discussion we should have had 12 years ago in this country, and in a very serious way, which is how far are we willing to go in policies that ultimately are inspired by fear. Yeah. You know, we're operating out of fear as a society. When the Boston Marathon bombing happened, then they declared martial law in Boston, and they, you know, we shut it down, and you have calls for people to be treated as enemy combatants, and you know, we're motivated, I think, by the power of nightmares.
Yeah.
But how do you dismantle that? I think it's so deeply ingrained now in the conscience of our society that it's a real uphill battle. I thought it was a positive thing when Rand Paul, the Tea Party senator, who I think is utterly reprehensible in so many ways with the policies that he takes about on racial issues, on women's rights issues, on women's health care issues. I mean, you could go down the line. But
that doesn't
mean
he's wrong on everything.
Right. So, and I didn't do I Stand With Rand because I don't stand with Rand.
Right.
But I did think that he did something that was epic. He shut down the nomination process of John Brennan as CIA director, demanding that the White House provide information on how Americans get on and off of kill lists. And he read into the record great reporting of people like Glenn Greenwald or Spencer Ackerman and, you know, people that have been covering the drone strike issue. And he put on record for the first time the fact that the United States killed these three U.S. citizens in a 2-week period. And so about 33% of that day was some of the most sane talk that we've had on the floor of the Senate about these issues. And then the rest of the two-thirds was just the dingbat factory from the Tea Party coming in and talking about Jane Fonda being blown up in a cafe in Berkeley. Yeah. You know, and the idea, was the president going to kill Jane Fonda for hanging out with the Viet Cong? But the point being, if it's left to someone like Rand Paul to raise these questions, we're never going to get anywhere. I mean, where are the sort of Democrats who were going after Bush on these issues in the Congress? I mean, where have they been? They're out to lunch. And it's Ron Wyden is probably the best senator on this issue right now. I mean, I wish Russ Feingold was back in the Senate, because he would have been going after this. But, you know, Ron Wyden of Oregon is doing it, and he's so timid, but he's doing the right thing, but he's so timid. We need to have actual lawmakers that represent us, you know, on a whole slew of issues. But they just, I mean, it really feels like it's like herding cats, you know, to try to get them to do anything.
How do we get there? I ask myself this all the time. I mean, education is really the only thing I can think about, but it seems like the education that's required is so remedial. Recently I blogged or tweeted, I can't remember. I said, so many Americans think that the rule of law actually means the suggestion of guideline. And of course I meant it to be somewhat facetious, but it's true. I mean, you talk to people and they say, you saw Lindsey Graham is a senator, talking about, well, we shouldn't Mirandize this guy, he should just be shipped straight to Guantanamo. And it's astonishing to me that a senator would say we should just ad hoc deny certain people due process of law, constitutional due process of law. I mean, you must, in order to say something like that, it means you don't understand what the law is. And this is a very fundamental and remedial concept.
Well, you know, I've talked to people that are, you know, JSOC, for instance, as a force, they do report to the Senate Armed Services Committee. And they have they do in-camera briefings, you know, they do these secret briefings. And I've talked to people that have been privy to those briefings, and they were saying, you know, I'm trying to understand like what the relationship is between the handful of people in the U.S. government that actually technically have oversight capabilities of this elite force, and sort of what is happening around the world. And what I've been told is that the senators never ask any probing questions that would get to the heart of what's wrong with using these forces in the way we're using them, because they don't want to know the answer. Yeah. Because knowledge, it's a burden then. There's a moral burden on you when you're faced with certain realities.
Yes.
I mean, there are photos in the book, and I a couple of the photos are just pictures of kids in Yemen. Yeah. And in one of the photos in the book, there's this little girl who was a survivor of the strike in Al-Majla in December of 2009. And I think about her every day, because when we were taking pictures of her and filming interviews with some of the people there, she was staring at me, and her eyes are so adult. She's a tiny kid, but her
picture.
Eyes are adult. But if you blow that picture up, and this is why it always has sort of haunts me, if you blow it up, you can see in her eye the reflection of me standing in front of her. Very clearly, you can see me and Rick Rowley, the director of our film and a wonderful cameraman, when he took the picture. And for me, that speaks volumes to what it would take to actually change hearts and minds in this country. If the victims of the Majula bombing, if we knew their stories the way that we know the stories of a story of the 8-year-old boy who was killed in the Boston Marathon bombing and the beautiful picture that he did on Facebook, I don't think Americans would support this. We don't even know who we're killing in these countries.
Yes.
I mean, so I've been saying, you know, I'm not a policy guy, but I really think that it's whether you support drone strikes because you think it's a cleaner, smarter form of war, or you're against them, I think we can all agree that the point has come where there should be a moratorium on it so we can figure out who's actually been killed, like Governor Ryan did in Illinois with the death penalty.
Yeah.
It wasn't because he was a radical leftist at all.
Yeah.
It was because innocent people were being killed, and they knew that from DNA evidence. So, you know, I think it's logical, and I think it's a reasonable thing to ask that we actually know who we're killing in our wars.
God almighty, I totally agree, although when you think about the signature strike, the concept of signature strikes, and again, given the composition of this audience, probably doesn't need to be explained, but these are people who are being assassinated, their names are unknown. They're just
based on patterns of life.
Exactly,
yeah.
Patterns of behavior, like they're climbing on monkey bars, which is everyone knows is something that terrorists in training like to do. So it's actually this program by design, signature strikes by design, you don't know the people's name. So I suppose if you were to say to policymakers, shouldn't we have a moratorium while we figure out who these people are? I'm afraid the honest response is, Jeremy, we don't care who they are. They were on the monkey bars.
Yeah, but although, I mean, I was recently talking to a guy who I have to be careful here, who was in the CIA and worked on Somalia and Yemen issues in the CIA up until very recently. And he told me that everyone he knows is against the signature strike policy, that the people that are doing the actual intelligence work in Yemen and Somalia. Not the people planning the operations, but the people who are actually monitoring who the threats are, whether we're going to be more safe or less safe as a result of a particular decision, military decision, and that there's great consternation within that community right now, because when we're doing these signature strikes, which is such a, it's so Orwellian the way that we come up with, you were talking about language earlier,
oh, yeah.
Terror Tuesdays, signature strikes, crowd killing pads, disposition matrix, which is almost like creating a computer algorithm for deciding when you assassinate someone and when you try to actually capture them, and it's sort of Brennan's legacy will be the disposition matrix. But you have this, I think, consternation within that community, because I think that there are very good people that work. I mean, you're a good person, Barry, and you were working in the CIA. I don't know if you were a good person when you were in the CIA, but you are now. but I know people, and it's why Cheney and Rumsfeld hated the CIA, is that they considered it a liberal bunch of, I think they called them pansies. And of course, that's not true. But there are analysts there. There are people that really, their whole life, what they believe they're doing is keeping the country safe. Yes. They don't like this either. And I mean, and so you say, well, they should speak out. Well, what happened to Thomas Drake, the former NSA official? They will ruin your career.
Yeah, that's right.
This presidency has gone after the whistleblowers in an unprecedented way.
Right.
And so we have this chill effect that's happened where people that would want to speak out are afraid because their lives are going to be destroyed.
Yeah, it's even more dangerous now than it ever was before. Yeah. I know we're going to be getting to Q&A in just a minute, and there was one thing I wanted to bring up, and you touched on it a minute ago, in talking about the way you are going to these dangerous places and bringing back the stories of the people who are most directly affected, that is, the people who are killed and the people who are bereaved. By losing their husbands, wives, and children in these drone strikes. What motivates you? What makes you do this? I mean, it's not, you don't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, salute, and you don't have your signature on the masthead of the New York Times, for example. You're not a talking head on TV. You're doing really, really important journalism. But as you say, often the people who are doing the most important journalism are, relatively speaking, unsung. What keeps you doing it? What motivates you? You're intense. Where does it come from?
I started off in journalism working with the great Amy Goodman of Democracy Now, who really has just been, I still list Democracy Now as my university on Facebook. You know, that's where I went to school. I learned journalism as a trade, like a carpenter or a plumber, as an apprentice. I've never taken a journalism class, which is probably why I'm still a journalist. I actually got rejected. I applied for an internship at The Nation magazine, and I was rejected. And now I'm their national security correspondent. So I always tell the interns,
hilarious,
you guys are already a step ahead of me. But you asked a motivation question. I believe in America as a country. I really do. And if I didn't, I would leave. The thing about love it or leave it.
Yes.
But I believe that part of changing the country and defending what is right about it. There's so much that's wrong about the history of America, and we could start from the very foundation of the country. But when I talk about America, I'm talking about people. Like, I think we have a great spirit as a society. We have an obligation, and this is what drives me. I feel that we have an obligation to go to the other side of the barrel of the gun and talk to the people that we're being told are our enemies. And I also feel like I believe with fierce passion that we have an obligation to tell the stories of people in countries around the world who are impacted by our policies in operations paid for with our money, and that telling their story is part of fighting for the future of our country too. And I think that's what good journalism does. It's twofold. It gives voice to the voiceless, and it holds those in power accountable. And at the end of the day, what I want this book to be is actionable intelligence for citizens to it's a intelligence term, but I want, as you know, I want it to be actionable intelligence that people can use to inform their decisions on what they think a policy should be or shouldn't be, and decide whether or not they want to get off their butt and try to do something about it.
Well, I think the book admirably accomplishes that. I'm gonna plug it again when we're done with the Q&A, because it is really an amazing book. But we'll get to that in a second. Is it time? All right, I am required, and I forgot to bang the gavel at the beginning of this thing.
Can I bang it?
I think you can. I thought this was a coaster. One more.
I feel so powerful, Barry. I'm going to hold on to the gavel. For those of you listening, I'm holding the gavel.
Thor with Mjolnir. Okay, so, I think I forgot to give people the 5-minute white did. Sorry. So if you have any questions, and probably there are some burning ones, this would be a good time to start formulating them.
I think there's already some formulated out there.
You'll have to formulate them more quickly than was originally planned.
Yeah.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum, Connect Your Intellect, and tonight we're hosting Jeremy Scahill, reporter for The Nation and author of Dirty Wars. And I'm Barry Eisler, blogger, novelist, and former CIA. Now, how am I doing? Let's hear from our audience, and remember we are looking for, yeah, I got to remind you, remember the single one-part questions that are actually questions. You know, you're not going to be one of those microphone hogs and I have to cut you off. And it makes people feel awkward. Real questions
microphones.
With some brevity. And you got there are two microphones in back. So what you want to do is just line up there, and that's where you'll ask your question. We'll start on the right, and we'll alternate. Yes, sir.
Hi, Jeremy. I was wondering if you could speak to, I think there are efforts in recent days to make the authorization for military force permanent and for Congress to kind of abdicate its responsibility to the executive branch. I was wondering if you had any further updates on that or could speak to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are sort of two camps right now. There's a small number of Congress people that are trying to initiate some effort to repeal the AUMF, and then there's a more dominant group that wants to rejigger some of the language in it so that there's clearer authorities to do the kinds of actions that the Obama administration is doing and in various countries around the world. I do think that ultimately the first step toward ending the mentality that the world is a battlefield would be to repeal the AUMF. But at the end of the day, this is all kind of a political game. Article 2 of the Constitution is what Cheney loved to point to, and what Obama's people, if you really press them on that privately, they'll say, as Commander-in-Chief, he has the authority to do this already, and we don't need the AUMF. But you know, this is part of its political theater, and part of it is that some very powerful Republicans who are influential in foreign policy are working with some powerful Democrats, and they are really trying to legitimize this program so that it can endure beyond this administration. And thank you for that question.
For anyone who's curious about where the president, first President Bush and now President Obama, argues that the authority for these lethal operations comes from, many of you, I'm sure, read Marcy Wheeler, journalist and blogger at Empty Wheel, and she's been all over this this claimed authority under Article 2 versus claimed authority under the AUMF. It's,
yeah.
it's a very interesting issue. Yes, sir.
I have a question about perhaps another take on the title, Dirty Wars. The environmental impact of all these wars, from the depleted uranium to just the huge petroleum use, or there's been rumors that Israel was considering striking a nuclear reactor in Iran. It's a pretty open question, but your take on it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you raised it, and it's a little bit outside of my lane. I mean, there's a British journalist who has been looking into trying to do an environmental impact study on drones in Yemen, and to try to actually see the potential environmental impacts of Hellfire missiles that are fired from the Predators. To my knowledge, there hasn't really been a study yet of what is contained within those missiles. I mean, I did a lot of work on depleted uranium in the 1990s in Iraq, and just for people to understand, the U.S. was using these depleted uranium missiles, and also in some cases they were using them in bullet form too, and they did incredible environmental damage to Iraq, and were directly linked to a severe increase in birth defects, particularly in southern Iraq, which was hit very hard with depleted uranium munitions. But in general, I mean, the whole war machine is just like one just catastrophic threat to the environment writ large. I mean, it's just you're right to point that out, and it is indeed very, very dirty. Yeah.
Everything you and Rick Rowley document is paid for by our tax dollars, which means that we're complicit. Please speak more about that. It's not only, you know, the evil Cheney and the compromised Democrats. It is us paying for it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said at the end that I think ultimately, you know, we have to see the other. You know, we have to see the others and see them as human beings and internalize. We need to personalize U.S. foreign policy if we're paying for it. I mean, unless you're some kind of a radical tax resistor, or you hover below, you know, you're a student and you hover below the sort of taxable income levels, you're a part of every missile that's launched and every night raid that takes place in Afghanistan. And so, what you know, what we all as a society do about that or say about that speaks volumes to who we actually are. It was why when Barry said, why do I do it? I mean, that is a big part of it. I don't want to be complicit, in killing civilians in countries around the world. I believe nations have a right to defend themselves. I don't think we're engaged in a war of defense at all. And if we ever were, when after 9/11, I'm not sure that we ever were in a defensive posture, really. And that's sad for me to say that as an American, because what were all the thousands of American lives lost, the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans and Yemenis and Pakistanis? I mean, what's been the point of any of this if it didn't make us safer?
Why do you think a lot of liberals become hawks under Obama, and how does that make you feel as a fellow progressive?
Well, I could give a cynical answer about about the question of liberals supporting I don't think it's necessarily that liberals have become hawks under Obama. There is this phenomenon of what I call cruise missile liberals, where they're sort of the idea that there are these humanitarian wars that the U.S. fights. The Democrats love that, and it was Clinton with Kosovo and Bosnia, and that's sort of how it's presented. And they're the same crowd is gearing up with Syria to make that argument. That's more of the sort of permanent state. That's how Democrats wage war, and it comes up every time there's a Democratic administration. With Obama, though, it's something a little bit different, which is that I think that a lot of liberals have bought into the idea that they trust President Obama. There's a real cult of personality around the fervent supporters of Obama, that he is such an intelligent, articulate guy, and that this is a smarter way of fighting war. And I think that's real for people. I think a lot of the reason a lot of liberals, wanted Bush out of office is because of all of the excesses and abuses of those, of the 8 years of that administration. But I do think that it's motivated by a genuine belief that President Obama is doing the right thing. Now, I disagree with them, but I do think it's sincere. And I don't think it's that they become hawks. I think it's that they sort of check their conscience at the door, or rather give their conscience to a political figure, which is, I think, what's ultimately happened. So that's why you see 70% of self-identified liberals supporting drone strikes. There's no way that would be the case if John McCain had won that election in 2008. So, I think it's going to be tough if Rubio or Jeb Bush get into office and they say, well, we can kill American citizens without trial. I mean, there's going to be impeachment.
But it's right. It's going to be a hard argument to make at that point.
It's a good question. Thank you.
I guess my question is really, how much do you see that these policies are really the result of financial interests that stand to gain from our military involvement in these other countries?
Yeah, I mean, nothing will ever fundamentally change in our society unless we radically confront corporate money in our electoral process. To me, that is like the premier, any issue that you're fighting on, the premier issue is the control that corporations have over members of Congress. I mean, members of Congress serve 2-year terms. They spend probably a full year of that raising money to keep themselves in office instead of actually working hard on these issues. And they are professional fundraisers. And it's very easy if you have the defense contractors writing fat checks to your reelection campaign to not have to spend so much time fundraising. Those war contractors put a lot of pressure on politicians to vote for policies that are going to benefit the war industry. I don't even think you don't need a conspiracy of fat white dudes smoking cigars in a back room anymore, telling newspapers what to print or congresspeople how to vote. It's become so ingrained in the mentality of lawmakers that they are going to vote according to who funds their campaigns. If we don't strip out corporate cash from our electoral process, I don't think any of these issues we're going to ever see any real movement on.
Hi. As you've discussed, the last several administrations really have cast terrorism as a threat to the American Republic, its very existence. But could you really describe what would be the impact of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, for example, in the short term, or non-involvement in Yemen, what the real impact was? And just to violate the rule on a quick second question, do you know why Democracy Now! Talks about Russia very little? Or does it talk about it?
I mean, I'm not on staff at Democracy Now!, so I can't. I mean, you can try to ask someone from Democracy Now! About that. I mean, I work with them, and I love them, but I'm not involved with running it anymore. To the first part of your question, I mean, it's hard to answer like a hypothetical what's going to happen when the U.S. Leaves Afghanistan. First of all, I think that there is going to be a residual strike force in Afghanistan of special operations forces that will continue to operate there hunting people that are affiliated with the Haqqani network or certain elements of the Taliban. I think there are areas of Afghanistan that have benefited from the U.S. presence, where you have girls going to school and you have a safer reality for women. It's undoubtedly true that exists in certain pockets of the country. But for large portions of the rest of the country, the Taliban are still in control, and you have the regular strikes by the U.S. and night raids, and I think that it's going to be a mixed bag. I think in some areas it will be much better for Afghans when we leave, and in some pockets I think that there would be the threat of the Taliban taking over again. But I ultimately think that it's a graveyard of empires in Afghanistan, and I don't know anyone in the military that thinks we should be there anymore. That it's unclear what the mission even is. In Iraq, the war is going to start up again. We have CIA paramilitaries there. We have contractors there. We're going to have these low-intensity conflicts raging in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think, for years to come. On the Yemen issue, I actually think that had we not started bombing Yemen, that Yemen would not be registering much of a blip at all on the terrorism radar. I think that it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And, it's not that I don't want potential airplane bombers to be brought to justice. It's that I don't think we should be killing military-age males whose names we don't know in the pursuit of those admittedly horrid criminals. And, I believe that we need to go back to using our civilian system to prosecute criminals. That's what this is. Terrorism it's a crime. It's not, this isn't war. These are crimes being plotted against the United States or against American citizens. And I want us to have a smart policy to deal with those people. Thank you.
Last year, there was a great study by NYU, Stanford, on the escalating drone strikes, and you hear very little about it, but how do you bring things like that back to the forefront in keen journalistic work as yours to have actionable intelligence for policymakers and actually have influence there?
One of the greatest resources I know of on online right now, and everyone should check it out, is the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is based out of London. Phenomenal, creative, new approach to covering these drone strikes, and very reliable data, and run by veteran journalists, and it's a fantastic project. And I think that could be a tool for people on this issue to send lawmakers or whoever to the studies that are being done by the Bureau for Investigative Journalism.
It seems like the notion of honor in the military is based on trained soldiers going to other countries and fighting other trained soldiers to defend their country. And I wonder how much drone strikes have undermined that notion of honor within the military establishment itself.
There was going to be a medal given for drone pilots, and then there was an uproar about that, and then they backed off of giving the drone pilot medal out. It's asymmetric war now. I mean, there really isn't. I don't think we're going to see anytime soon the United States engaged in a uniform to uniform battle. It's asymmetric warfare. And Stanley McChrystal, who ran JSOC for the Bush era and really led the campaign in Iraq. At one point said that in order to fight Al-Qaeda, we had to become like them, in sort of our mentality. And I don't think he meant it in this way, but we sort of have in the way that we're dealing with Yemen. What's terrorism to, to a Yemeni who lived in that village that got hit with a cruise missile? Well, terrorism is a drone, or terrorism is a Tomahawk cruise missile. And it's all relative, but I think, it's a very interesting point.
Do we have time for one more question, or should I go to the 60-second? One more question.
All right. And I'm happy to stick around and talk to folks too, when I'm signing books.
Okay.
So last year when occupiers were protesting Obama's fundraiser in Oakland, I had a sign that said cruise missile liberals, and I directed them to your Twitter, everyone who stopped me. But anyway, so my question is, I've been doing media work for a year and a half now with different activist groups, and I've seen that difference that you're kind of talking about the people who do it as a trade, who kind of learn it that way, and the people who are either doing it through academia or through a corporate media lens or what have you. So could you talk a little bit more about how you got started? And I don't know how much you want to get into that, but
yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just say it briefly. I mean, I as I said, I didn't take a journalism class, but I really loved Democracy Now! When it came on the air, and I was working at a homeless shelter at the time in D.C. And was listening to a lot of talk radio, and I heard, you know, Amy Goodman. I think it was a report about the rebels in the Congo trying to overthrow Mobutu Sese Seko, and I had never heard of any of this. I thought it was like the coolest thing in the world that there was this sort of amazing, you know, woman who it was just a voice to me at the time, presenting this information I had never heard. And I started to I started to write her letters, and I basically was stalking her for a year. And I like to say that Amy had to decide whether to get a restraining order against me or like let me come in and volunteer. So I basically cut my teeth at Democracy Now! Initially as a coffee runner. Amy was paying me $20 a day out of her pocket at one point to write her news headlines. And then it eventually turned into I got a part-time job with them as like an assistant producer. At the time, it was just Amy and one other person working there when I came to Democracy Now! They had just been thrown off of every radio station in the state of Pennsylvania for airing the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So they got taken off of every single radio station. That was right when I got to Democracy Now! And, you know, I got good at the technical side of radio, cutting, editing on the old reel-to-reel tapes, and started to work with journalists who I admired and helped them out. And basically just started begging for money from, I'm a professional beggar now, begging for money. At the time it was from, you know, family and friends asking for $50 to contribute to a plane ticket. And I started to go to places and I would stay as long as I could with the money that I had. And I would find translators by going to the local university in Baghdad or in Belgrade in Serbia and meeting college students and saying, you know, would you be willing to help me out? Because I didn't have money to hire a translator. So I met a lot of college students and I was sort of hodgepodging it. And I've met incredible people, and almost everyone that I admire from that are journalists in other countries, none of them have journalism degrees. They're all people that ended up going to a war zone because they felt like, I'm just going to give it a try. I want to try to be a reporter, and they went there. And it's you just meet amazing people. And I don't encourage young people to drop out of college, but I do think that you shouldn't let school get in the way of your education if you want to, you know, sort of make a change in the world.
That's a great line. I have one last question for Jeremy. It's a 60-second question, and it is an in-forum tradition. Before I ask it, I just want to mention...
Oh, they briefed me on this, and I forgot what it is. I was supposed to think of something. Oh, no. No, I'm just kidding.
So I'm going to talk slowly now. So I should have mentioned at the beginning that you can find us online at commonwealthclub.org.inforum. And for more about Inforum and its upcoming events, you can like the Facebook page, facebook.com/InforumSF. Or follow at InformSF on Twitter. And you can also watch Commonwealth Club programs on fora.tv. And before the question, I just want to tell you again, this book really, it's awesome. If you read Jane Meyer's The Dark Side, to me, Jane Meyer's The Dark Side was like, at the time, it was a definitive study of the origin of what is now known as the War on Terror or America's descent into the dark side. But a lot has happened in the intervening decade, and what Jeremy has, there's a lot more to cover. Jeremy has covered all of it. It's practically an encyclopedia, but it doesn't read like an encyclopedia. It is a compelling story. It's really an amazing book. I believe it's on sale outside. Yeah, and are you going to be signing copies?
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
So Jeremy's going to be here to sign copies. It's really a terrific book. And also, you know, an autographed copy makes a great gift, too, so you can buy two.
You're hired, Barry.
All right, here it is. It's time for our last question, and it's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. Jeremy, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I think that it should be the responsibility of every American to make it their business to know, to research the story of one person who's been killed in a U.S. military operation that was an innocent civilian. And to read their story and know it, and try to find as much information about them as they can, so that when you have these discussions about our policies, that there's a real story that you know and that you've internalized and you've owned as your own, almost like adopting a story. I think if we all adopt a story from halfway around the world of someone whose life was either ended or impacted in a tragic way by our policies, then we can't just be turning a blind eye to the realities of what our foreign policy is doing around the world. And, you know, I think it's a simple idea, but there's a broader principle there. And it's one that I try to particularly talk to a lot of young people about, that, you know, empathy is a powerful, powerful force.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, I think that empathy results in people standing up for themselves and standing up for others. And that's the, I think that's the main motivating force, is that you see them as one of your own. And we need to do that with people that are impacted by our policies.
Awesome idea.
And thank you guys so much. This is really an honor to be with you. And thank you, Barry. Thank you, Commonwealth Club.
I was going to invite you to give Jeremy a big round of applause, but he was so awesome. There was no need. My job is just to bang the gavel 3 times. Thank you very much, everyone.
All right. Thank you.